Welcome to Trained, a podcast exploring the cutting edge of holistic fitness. I'm Ryan Flaherty, Senior Director of Performance at Nike. For now, I'm still recording from my office, calling up some of the world's leading experts in mindset, movement, nutrition, recovery, and sleep to discuss all the ways you can train your body and mind. Today, I'll be talking with a scientist who's breaking new ground in our understanding of women's physiology in sport and training.
The menstrual cycle is actually a sign of health. It's a normal natural process. Hormones are fluctuating in a cyclical manner, and actually having a regular menstrual cycle suggests that your body is in a good state of health. We call it a vital sign, and it suggests that your body can adapt and get the most out of what it's doing, you know, be it in work life, be it in exercise performance. Like, it's a really important marker that women are lucky to have. And I think reframing it in that regard, firstly, is important.
That was Dr. Georgie Brunvilles, a senior research scientist at Orico, creators of the Fitter Woman app, talking about how important it is to look at the menstrual cycle positively, even to look at it as a guide. And not just during menstruation. Georgie's research shows that learning about the entire hormonal cycle can help you time your training and recovery to increase results and decrease symptoms. This kind of research has been a long time coming. It seems like for the last 100 years, studying performance has meant studying men's performance. Georgie and scientists like her are changing that, and they're having an impact far beyond the lab. Today, we'll be getting into the state of the science. We'll discuss how you can hone your training for each specific phase of your cycle, and we'll even debunk a few myths while we're at it. Hey, Georgie, how are you?
Thank you very much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
I'm really excited to have you on the show, and I've been really looking forward to this conversation. I just want to start with a little background on you, your career, and then your research on the menstrual cycle and performance.
Yeah, so I think as a person, I've always been interested in the way the body works. I remember I must have been like 14 getting this book on the human body, and I was like, oh my God, this is so interesting. And I want to learn like everything. I wanted to memorize the whole book. So it was a no-brainer for me to go to uni and study actual physiology. So my undergraduate degree was in physiological science, and I enjoyed it so much. And I felt like I'd come out of lectures just so inspired. And I put loads of pressure on myself to do as well as I could through uni. And I think I needed to take a step back. And so I didn't want to keep straight going into academia. So I just wanted to come out for a bit. And I just stumbled across this job at UK Anti-Doping, managing the testing program. And that gave me a really good mix of working with athletes on the education side, but also planning the testing, understanding the science. And I got to work at the London 2012 Games. And oh my gosh, that was the most incredible event. I wrote to a load of different people who I would look up to in the science world. And I just said, how did you get to your job? And they said, go and do a PhD. So I did a PhD, very much focusing on female physiology and the menstrual cycle, iron deficiency, etc. And that's really how this chapter in my life began. And ever since then, I guess I haven't really looked back.
But you also got to this point as a runner, right? I mean, you ran at a very high level. So, I mean, part of you being an athlete is also what created even a more passion for what you're researching today, correct?
100%. So firstly, going way back to when I was younger, I started off, I guess, doing all sports, but I did a lot of swimming, and I'd be swimming with the boys. And there was a time where I could keep up with them. And same when I was running against them, I keep up with them. And then suddenly they got so much better. But I was like, why aren't I getting better like that? Obviously, I understand that now. But the gender divide in like physiological elements just wasn't a thing, or was never explained to me. And that really frustrated me. And then I guess like over time, just so many things have come together to really fuel this fire of passion around really understanding what a woman needs to support their training. And I'm also very keen on doing exercise myself and take my own athletic career relatively seriously. So for me, it was always like, I want to understand everything to make me the best version of myself. But then over time, that has massively changed to like, what about everyone? Why can't we understand this better to help so many different people?
So what motivated you to look into menstrual cycles for athletes and in relation to performance? Was there one aha moment for you?
I think my real penny drop moment was the first day of my PhD involved interviewing a load of women at the London Marathon pre-event exhibition where you go and collect your number. And I spoke to 1,074 women, I think 3 days out from the marathon. And I literally interviewed them one by one. It was a great thing to do when you, yeah. I'd actually just run my first marathon as well, like a few days before. So that was, my legs were very tired by the end of the week. But anyway, I think it quickly became obvious to me that there were so many questions that they were asking around their menstrual cycle and they had no idea. Like, I'm going to be menstruating on Sunday on the day of the London Marathon. Can I actually run? Or I am premenstrual just before the marathon. What should I do? How can I help myself? I get such bad symptoms. Can I just take loads of painkillers? And there was just question after question after question. And I felt like me being there conducting a questionnaire around women's health gave them that motivation and almost like a sense of passage to suddenly say, I can ask this question. And it was like this had never been asked before. And then I quickly realized that while in my head, everyone understands this because I went to uni and I studied it. And obviously through my own kind of training myself, I understood it. I quickly realized that most women out there don't understand this. Yeah, it's holding them back. But also they just suffer in silence. And I think that's not okay.
So I want to take a step back and I just want to talk through the foundations of your research. Can you give us a brief overview of the menstrual cycle? You know, like what happens physiologically throughout each phase and then how those phases relate to training.
Okay, so stepping back, the menstrual cycle is actually a sign of health. It's a normal natural process. Hormones are fluctuating in a cyclical manner. And actually having a regular menstrual cycle suggests that your body is in a good state of health. We call it a vital sign. It's a really important marker that women are lucky to have. People talk about the menstrual cycle and just think about bleeding. They think about periods and they think, oh, that's really gross. But actually, hormones are continually changing. There's this continual variation, fluctuation, as we call it, in hormones that brings about this menstruation. But that's almost like a byproduct of the whole process. On any one day of the menstrual cycle, the two primary ovarian hormones, estrogen and progesterone, are constantly changing. So it's a very complex process as to how they're released, but effectively they're released from the ovaries and the amount that is released varies based on where someone is in their menstrual cycle. And these hormones travel in your blood. So they travel to your brain, to your feet, to your fingers, to your heart, to your lungs. So they can affect the way you move, the way you think, the way you feel, the way your body like adapts and responds. As part of my work at Orico, we've labeled the menstrual cycle stages into phases. So we have a phase one, which is like when an individual is actually menstruating, a phase two, which is the second half of the follicular phase, which is the first half of the menstrual cycle, a phase three, which is like the early part of the luteal phase, early to sort of mid. And then the phase four is the premenstrual phase. Now we use that as a new kind of terminology that doesn't have the, oh, you're on your period. It's, oh, you're in phase one.
Yeah, I just think it's really smart to break it down in those terms. And it's just a lot more specific and I think helpful for people.
Yeah. And I think, like, again, terming everything in phases, like the Chelsea women's football team, who are one of my clients, I just feel so, in a way, so proud when I hear them, you know, shouting down the corridor, oh, are you in phase one? Okay, yeah. No, I'm in phase two. Like, it's so normal. Whereas that would never be, oh, are you on your period? Like, I just think it's like objectifying the whole situation. We are inherently lacking across the world education in this area. The one country that I really feel is the driving force and I've been so impressed with is New Zealand. They're so open to this. They've got an amazing team down there really embracing the area. Whereas I think the, you know, particularly in the UK, like the stiff upper lip British approach, like you wouldn't talk about periods. That's the curse. Why would you mention that? But actually, I think we need to get education at the grassroots level for athletes, but also coaches and parents. So one thing that we've done is we've kind of built different levels of education based on the age of athletes and making sure that youngsters' parents are educated too. And the coach, it's all well and good educating an athlete, but if you don't educate a coach, then how is the athlete supposed to have that conversation with the coach? And I also think often the coach, if if they don't have the education, they wouldn't know what to say. They wouldn't know how to approach it. So we have this free app, Fitter Women, F-I-T-R, Woman, which is available free on all downloading services, mm-hmm. Google, Apple, etc. And that can link up, if you want it to a coach platform. So the coach platform is called Fitter Coach, so F-I-T-R, Coach. Mm-hmm. The athlete has complete control of that. So they can link up to their coach, but they can also remove themselves from their coach's platform at any time. Our coach platform, I feel as like, in my eyes, this was kind of the turning point of like, yeah, we're getting somewhere, because it's all well and good having the athlete or the athlete having that information, but or the coach needs to have the education as well, as I've already highlighted.
Couldn't agree more. And it's such, I mean, you guys are building such an amazing tool, and the work you're doing is really incredible. So I just want to make sure I say that.
Thank you. There's a long way to go, but it's exciting.
Yeah, of course. But we needed more people like you who are leading that charge, because there are so many athletes out there who can benefit from your work. And so keeping that in mind, you know, what can athletes of any level really do once they understand each phase to make the most of their training?
So you start in phase one, which is the bleed phase. The primary hormones, estrogen and progesterone, fluctuate.
Right.
And to bring about menstruation, the levels of those hormones have to drop off. So the amount that's released has to decrease, which then brings about the shedding of the uterus lining, which is menstruation. Now, when that shedding occurs, there's this associated inflammatory response. And that effectively comes as a part of this shedding process, but it also, we have found and seen that higher levels of inflammation travel around the body. So actually, a lot of the symptoms that people can experience are due to the higher levels of inflammation. We also know that there's a change in oxidative stress, and there's been some really nice research done showing the changes in neurobiology as well. So like the impact of the withdrawal of hormones, and all of those combined can result in symptoms.
Yeah.
Now, in terms of proactive things to do and what that means, so for some people, if there's higher levels of inflammation in their body, then they can take a bit longer to recover from training. Or I would flip it on its head and say more of a focus needs to be placed on recovery, because at the end of the day, anyone needs to perform day in, day out. Like, if it's your Olympic final and you're on day one of your menstrual cycle and maybe that's bad for you, you've still got to perform. So you've got to work out what works for you.
Do you have any recommendations about what athletes can do from a nutrition perspective?
Yes. Yeah, so I would say anti-inflammatory focus 100%. Think about having foods that are high in fiber as well, to help with the kind of processing of those, the metabolism of the hormones which have just decreased. Often we talk about, oh, just take a painkiller to manage symptoms. Well, actually, let's try and do that naturally as opposed to really needing to take painkillers. If you are experiencing cravings, which typically might come premenstrually, but that's your body telling you that your insulin resistance is altering a little bit. So like regularly fueling to try and preempt the cravings. But lots of the athletes I would work with, I would say, well, aim for 7 to 10 portions of fruit and veg, aim for your oily fish, just try and reduce anything that's too processed.
Okay, so what's happening during phase two?
Yeah, moving on into phase two, for some people, this is where they feel great. Estrogen levels increase through phase two, and estrogen is a hormone that's associated with increased release of serotonin and dopamine, so like the happy hormones.
Yep.
We also know that estrogen has this oxidative capacity, so it can effectively, and it's been shown to help facilitate recovery of muscle tissue after intense exercise training. So there is some research that suggests that people may adapt better to certain forms of exercise, primarily strength conditioning work. My belief is that this is very much on an individual basis. So it's all about working out for athletes out there, like what or how their body's feeling, how their body's recovering. If they feel great at this time, then maybe push on a little bit. In terms of nutrition, there is some evidence again, just to suggest that the need to carbohydrate load before any kind of intense or longer endurance effort is increased. So just remembering to have enough carbohydrates would be important. Then you jump into phase three, which is the second half of the menstrual cycle. I love phase three. I feel like it's where you can just be so proactive, and it's really cool. In phase three, estrogen slightly decreases in the middle of the cycle, but then in phase three, there's an increase in estrogen and an associated increase in progesterone. Some people call this the high hormone phase. Now, we know that progesterone is a catabolic hormone, so it breaks down muscle tissue. So if you think about it, you're building muscle, but then the progesterone just breaks it down. And obviously, in terms of exercise, like, it's always a kind of balance of breaking down muscle tissue and then building it stronger, but progesterone can increase that a little bit more. We also know that the higher levels of progesterone in this phase can slightly affect mood, can affect energy levels. It can also affect insulin sensitivity, so people can start experiencing cravings. So in phase three, my primary advice would be making sure that you're always going into exercise fueled with protein, so having had sufficient protein to mitigate that breakdown. We know, and it's been shown that can have a really positive effect. And also getting the protein in, primarily leucine as a type of protein, in the immediate aftermath from training, obviously alongside carbohydrate within that 30-minute window. And research shows that actually in women, this is more important than in men. Mm-hmm. I would also say, like, fueling frequency is something which you should look at changing in phase three. So we know, because of the body's slight shift in ability to control blood sugar levels, that people start experiencing cravings. So fueling regularly with a complex carbohydrate protein mix would be great. So then jumping into phase four, this is where hormones drop off to then bring about the release of the endometrial lining. And this is where there's an inflammatory response. So you want to focus on having anti-inflammatory foods again. Like, I love a daily smoothie, chuck in some flax seeds, chia seeds, all great. Now, it is really important to think that everyone is different. Some people have a way worse phase four than they do a phase one. But I also think that that tells you quite a lot about the way an individual can metabolize those hormones. Increasing fiber in phase four is also important. I guess some people, particularly in like maybe team sports or ball sports, really struggle with coordination and clumsiness again. So this is where you might need to shift things around to help reduce that.
After the break, Georgie debunks some common menstruation myths and gives us a preview of the research she's most excited about.
If you're enjoying this episode of Trained, here's some good news. You'll find more wellness expertise every day on Nike.com, the Nike app, the Nike Run Club app, and the Nike Training Club app. And in regions where NTC Premium is available, that's free now too. You can learn more about movement, mindset, nutrition, recovery, and sleep, and you can get started on a workout as soon as you finish this episode.
What is the most common question or comments or themes you hear from athletes that are just misinformation that you'd want to call out or just let people know that are listening?
I think the most common thing that drives me nuts is that it's normal to feel rubbish premenstrually or during a period. It's just this expectation that, hey, this is just what happens. It's part of me. Like, maybe there's 5 to 7 days every month where I feel rubbish, but yeah, hey, that's me. That blows my mind that there's been that level of acceptance for so long. And it also makes me think it's actually really sad for every woman out there. Like, if it's 5 days, if it's 7 days, that's 60 days plus a year where people just don't feel amazing.
Is there anything you'd tell people if they were, you know, going to talk to their doctor, whether it's a naturopath, their general practitioner or OBGYN, questions that you should be asking your doctor that maybe in the past you haven't? Is there specific things you coach people on?
Yeah. Okay. So I think firstly, if you think you might have an underlying menstrual dysfunction, I think going there, having tracked your cycle for a few cycles and saying, these are the symptoms I get, this is the, like, my typical blood flow. So logging in or not showing them, and highlighting that, and saying, look, I've tracked this for a few cycles and this is what I'm experiencing and I don't think this is normal. That gives them really objective evidence to say, hang on a minute, something isn't right into question. I would also say, if you do think you've got something that's a bit different, keep banging that door. Keep asking.
Yeah, always keep asking. you know, just listening to you talk about the different phases of menstruation highlights that women are not small men, and you can't use research on men around in a 6-week hypertrophy study to say that women are going to have the same response to that training, right? And that's like, that's the part that to me, it just shows there's such a need to continue to push research in a way that we haven't in the past. There was a, you know, historical bias to physiological research about women in the past. We all know that that's there. Can you talk about why that is?
Yes. Yeah, so it goes back quite a long way, actually. So before the Second World War, when research was really starting to be promoted and pushed forwards, there was this belief that actually we don't want to do research on women because what happens if they are carrying an unborn child and we don't know about it? Or what happens if the research, whatever shape or form that's in, actually harms their reproductive organs? So let's make women protected subjects and just say no research should be done on women. And then over time, so through the 50s, 60s, there was this increasing understanding that actually women and men might be a bit different. And yeah, okay, women aren't just men with female reproductive organs. And this realization was almost a curse, because it then meant that there was this kind of understanding that, hey, women's hormones do fluctuate. Women are more changeable. So doing research in women is way harder. And actually, it's more expensive as well, because you can't just test a woman on any day of their menstrual cycle and just say that, you know, the same goes on every single day. Like, every day is a little bit different. So there was a need, there would be a need for a greater number of participants in research studies, and that would make it more expensive and just more timely and more challenging. However, in the 80s, there was this big feminist movement, which culminated in the development of a task force all around women's health to say, right, enough's enough. We need to focus on that. So that was in 1985. And also, there was this real belief still that the main research that should be done in women is around their reproductive system. There wasn't an understanding that, hey, hormones actually travel in the blood. There's receptors, so little detectors for these hormones all around the body. And women's research was actually called bikini medicine.
Wow.
I know, it's nuts. But anyway, I guess now we're at a point where there is a massively increased understanding around the need, but it's just the practicalities and the budget required, or the financial commitment required to test women really is that much higher, which really does make it more challenging. But I still believe that doesn't mean we shouldn't be doing it. So,
absolutely.
You know, times are evolving, but it is, the momentum needs to keep building. And I think the time is now. We've just got to keep going, keep pushing, keep kind of banging the drum.
For a lot of athletes that I've worked with over the years, cramping is a major issue for some, where like we'll do 1-200 and late cannot get up off the ground. They're seeing complete white. They are out, done, cannot run, compete, practice, nothing. And I think the fear of that feeling coming up is probably what they're trying to delay, without understanding that there's options for them to manage those symptoms, right? And that's what I would love you to talk about, of like, for people who do have really bad menstrual cramps, like, what are some things that they can do to mitigate some of the pain or the intensity, I guess, of it?
Okay, first thing to say, some people genetically are more likely to have worse symptoms than others. That's just a thing that could be related to our metabolic pathways, the amount of hormone that we release, how our body processes that. But there's a lot of things that one, like, you can do to help yourself. Now, we know that stress is real. Stress really can have an effect on the menstrual cycle. It can make symptoms so much worse, or it can just elongate cycles. The number of people who I've seen with irregular periods recently is crazy.
Yeah.
So for some people, their body's natural stress response is to suppress everything: appetite suppression, menstrual cycle regularity suppression. Other people, it's like stress massively exacerbates. So worse symptoms, more hungry, just feel like they're going to explode.
Yeah.
And I think this is real. Everyone's talking about it. But in terms of specifics around the menstrual cycle, we know that premenstrually, one's body's ability to manage that stress is actually affected as well. So not only does stress, if you are in a stressful situation at that time, not only does that have an effect, but actually the body's ability to deal with it is affected. So we've tried loads of interventions around this. So looking at things like yoga, looking at things like Pilates, and finding an individual's happy place. It sounds ridiculous, but actually it's so powerful. Like yeah. I worked with a big team last year, and we had one athlete specifically who was really, really struggling with nausea and vomiting around her menstrual cycle. And actually doing some mindfulness with her was a game changer. It sounds simple, it sounds basic, but it's not. It really can be very powerful.
There's loads of data behind supporting that, yeah. So some of the research that you've done in your career is around iron deficiency. You know, I know for a lot of women, they hear this idea that, oh, you know, women are iron deficient. Can you talk about what some of the biggest myths around that or things that you hear from people that just need to, they may need to think differently about?
Yeah, great question. One that I'm extremely passionate about. So first thing is, big myth is that every woman out there is iron deficient and every woman out there needs to supplement with iron. No, definitely not. You should supplement with iron if you have been told by a medical professional to supplement with iron. And if your blood tests suggest that, or if you've had blood tests to suggest that you are deficient in iron. I personally was told to supplement with iron. My coach thought it was a good idea, my former coach, and I very nearly had to have a blood transfusion because my ferritin, which is a key marker, one of the key markers of iron status, was through the roof. So that should not be followed unless you're medically told to. That being said, it's a very good idea to optimize intake of iron-rich food. So your red meat, your pulses, your beans, your spinach, green leafy vegetables, etc. It's a really good thing to get them in on a regular basis. Now, again, I think there is a genetic predisposition to certain people being more susceptible to iron deficiency, but just because someone in your family might have it, don't presume. But also ask the question, particularly if you're a heavy bleeder, then your likelihood of being iron deficient is that much greater.
Higher, yeah.
And that's a lot of our research is very much looking at that, looking at the mechanism around it, what causes iron deficiency, whether actually iron deficiency causes heavy bleeding or heavy bleeding causes iron deficiency. That's a whole different conversation. The other thing is, if you are told to take iron tablets, then it's not always a question of like having as many as you can, because there's some really nice research out there highlighting that actually if you take iron tablets every single day, that actually the body's ability to absorb that may not be quite as good as taking them every other day. So it might be more of a case of less is more with iron supplementation.
Or microdosing or spreading the dose out. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, but also I would say ensuring that you're taking the iron as far away from training as possible is really important, because we know that, as we've talked about, as we train, there's an increase in inflammation. And actually, iron is toxic. So taking too much firstly is not a good thing. But the body is very clever at self-regulating around iron absorption into the bloodstream. And if you have just exercised, there's an increase in inflammation, which through a complicated mechanism effectively shuts down the body's ability to absorb this iron. So if you take iron in the immediate aftermath from training, there'll be limited absorption. So I would suggest taking it as far away from training as possible. And mainly, if you can, taking it on a sort of moderate to low intensity, after moderate to low intensity training session where there won't be so much inflammation, would definitely be advisable.
So one of the things I wanted to talk to you about, because you mentioned it earlier in the interview, and I loved what you said, rather than looking back and trying to go back and fix and, you know, things that we've maybe missed, like looking to the future of like what is possible. And for you, I would love to hear, what do you feel like is the most exciting frontiers in women physiology that you're looking forward to?
Good question. So right now, I think we're at this point where obviously coronavirus is ongoing, but we're at a time where we can really, I think, push this area forward. So yes, we could look at things very negative right now, negatively right now across women's sport and women's research generally. Like, so many research trials have had to be stopped. But actually, can we not use this time to say, now is the time? Now is the time to really factor in women across the board from a research perspective, from a performance perspective, in kind of reshaping the landscape. Now, I think you know, there's a lot of talk around individualized medicine. And as part of my role at Orica and as part of our female athlete program, I really like to individualize my work with our elite athletes. So work on a one-to-one basis to understand each individual cycle. The thing I guess really that's exciting me is the appreciation that we need to do things on this individual level, and we need to step on and think, well, hang on a minute, what about performance? What about training? What about nutrition? But from a optimizing perspective, I think that's really exciting. The more we can do to come up with smarter ways to measure hormones more regularly, to work out where someone is in their menstrual cycle, the better. There's more and more people globally doing research around female health, but there needs to be more. But it also needs to be looked at more positively. Like, I don't want to hear more newspapers saying, oh, X athlete didn't perform well because she was on her period. Like, that's ridiculous. We should just be training women as women, not just training women as men with periods. For example, women's football, women's soccer. Like, that shouldn't be compared to men's football, men's soccer. That is a different game, and there needs to be an appreciation for that as, like, actually, let's appreciate female physiology here. And the more we can do to really understand female physiology, the better. And I, more people are doing this. That really excites me.
You know, what I'm so excited about, just to add on to that, I'm answering the question that I asked you, basically, is I think we have yet to tap the potential of the world records that we've seen, of the potential of human performance.
Agreed.
Female human performance yet, because of the lack of research to help highlight the strengths that come with being a woman, and, and physiologically the differences that can make them perform at a high level that we have yet to see, I think is what I'm so excited about.
I 100% agree. And you've just discussed my second slide of my typical presentation I would give, because actually that is about, I really believe that women are getting faster, women are jumping higher and throwing further, but I believe they can get that much better if we actually train smarter.
Well, Georgie, thank you so much for the time. Personally, I've got so much out of this, and I really appreciate it.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I think this was one of the most practical, information-rich episodes we've ever done. Georgie's breakdown of each phase of the menstrual cycle was so thorough that I think anyone who menstruates or trains someone who does may want to listen to this a few times and take notes. Personally, one of the things that I found fascinating was the way that the menstrual cycle can act as a guide for how you structure your training routine, telling you when to decrease or increase intensity, focus on recovery, or adjust your diet. Knowing that you'll want to watch out for inflammation in phase one or up your protein in phase three, these are incredible opportunities to train and recover more efficiently and just feel better after your workout. On the next episode, I'll be talking with WNBA star Jewel Lloyd, also known as the Gold Mamba, about the intensive mental training she received from her friend and mentor, Kobe Bryant, and how she's passing that knowledge on to the next generation. This has been Trained. Talk to you soon. If you're enjoying this episode of Trained, help us spread the word by rating and reviewing the podcast. That way we can keep making great episodes for you to listen to. And it helps other people find us too. If you've got a question for me or my guests, or a topic you'd like to see covered, email me at trained@nike.com and I'll see what I can do.
Thanks for listening to Trained. Just a reminder, always talk with your doctor before starting any training or nutrition program. The information we provide, it's not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. And the individual opinions expressed here are just that, opinions. They shouldn't be taken as fact.